this evening's program, Justice Hall has something to say to us and to announce.
Been suggested that we hold silence for about 1 minute. Probably. Before we start.
We'll have a short reading of the sayings of Meher Baba on divine love. God, the real beloved, is ever ready to enter your house, the mind, but he cannot because it is occupied by your numberless, unreal beloved desires, and there is no room for him. You yourself are the cause of your separation from the beloved. Annihilate that which is called self, and you will thereby gain union with him. True love means the dedication of oneself or the complete surrender of oneself to the beloved. It seeks the unhappiness, it seeks the happiness of the beloved without the least desire of obtaining happiness from the beloved. The highest divine knowledge is attained through love, which has in it the spiritual faculties, intuition, and inspiration, and is opposed to the intellectual faculty. It is love that makes one transcend the dominion of intellect and gain the state of complete self-annihilation. It is this state that ends in union with God. Revenge follows hatred and forgiveness follows love. Without love, none can cultivate the noble habit of forgetting and forgiving. You forgive a wrong done to you in the same measure in which you love the wrongdoer. You cannot counteract a disease only by its antidote. Love is the only antidote to hatred. When you feel like hating a man, try to remind yourself that he is the form of your own self. The capital N. There is greater valor in conquering the heart of a single enemy than in gaining victory over the bodies of thousands of enemies. The mind is capable of turning the bitterest enemy into the sweetest friend by constantly thinking well, charitably, of him. Jealousy is not born of love, but of petty-mindedness, and dies simultaneously with the death of petty-mindedness. Real happiness lies in oneness. Wherever there is duality, there is trouble. Love resembles death in that it annihilates snobbery, vulgarity, and all distinctions. The trinkets of this world cannot tempt the true divine lover. He does not feel the appetites and cannot enjoy sound sleep. He resembles a fish just taken out of water. He is restless until he is united with the beloved. Divine love causes its captive to forget his own individual existence by making him feel less and less bound by the trammels of human limitations on his onward march, till he reaches a point where he can raise himself to the realization of the highest in himself. Of the High, Dehradun, India, 7th of September, 1953. On the morning of the 7th of September, it being the anniversary of Zoroaster's birth, Meher Baba gave the following message. Consciously or unconsciously, directly or indirectly, each and every creature, each and every human being, in one form or the other, strives to search individuality. But when eventually man consciously experiences that he is infinite, eternal, and indivisible, then he is fully conscious of his individuality as God, and as such experiences infinite knowledge, infinite power, and infinite bliss. Thus man becomes God and is recognized as a perfect master, Sadguru or Kutu. To worship this man is to worship God. When God manifests on earth in the form of man and reveals his divinity to mankind, he is recognized as the Avatar, the Messiah, the Prophet. Thus God becomes man. And so infinite God, age after age, throughout all cycles, wills through his infinite mercy to affect his presence amidst mankind by stooping down to human level in the human form. But his physical presence amidst mankind, not being apprehended, he is looked upon as an ordinary man of the world. When he asserts, however, his divinity on earth by proclaiming himself the Avatar of the age, he is worshipped by some who accept him as God, and glorified by few who know him as God on earth. But it invariably falls to the lot of the rest of humanity to condemn him while he is physically in their midst. Thus it is that God, as man, proclaiming himself as the Avatar, suffers himself to be persecuted and tortured, to be humiliated and condemned by humanity, for whose sake his infinite love has made him stoop so low, in order that humanity, by its very act of condemning God's manifestation in the form of Avatar, should, however indirectly, assert the existence of God in his infinite eternal state. The Avatar is always one and the same, because God is always one and the same, the eternal, indivisible, infinite one, who manifests himself in the form of man as the Avatar, as the Messiah, as the Prophet, as the Ancient One, the highest of the high. This eternally one and the same Avatar repeats his manifestations from time to time in different cycles, adopting different human forms in different names, in different places, to reveal truth in different garbs and different languages, in order to raise humanity from the pit of ignorance and help free it from the bondage of delusions. Of the most recognized and much worshipped manifestations of God as Avatar, that of Zoroaster is the earliest, having been before Ram, Krishna, Buddha, Jesus, and Mohammed. Thousands of years ago, he gave to the world the essence of truth in the form of three fundamental precepts: good thoughts, good words, and good deeds. These precepts were and are constantly unfolded to humanity in one form or another, directly or indirectly in every cycle, by the Avatar of the age, as he leads humanity imperceptibly towards the truth. To put these precepts of good thoughts, good words, and good deeds into practice is not as easily done as it would appear, though it is not impossible. But to live up to these precepts honestly and literally is as apparently impossible as it is to practice a living death in the midst of life. In the world, there are countless sadhus, mahatmas, maharapurushas, saints, yogis, and walis, though the number of genuine ones is very, very limited. The few genuine ones are, according to their spiritual status, in a category of their own, which is neither on a level with the ordinary human being, nor on a level with the state of the highest of the high. I am neither a Mahatma nor a Mahapurush, neither a Sadhu nor a saint. neither a yogi or a wali. Those who approach me with the desire to gain wealth or to retain their possessions, those who seek me through me relief from distress and suffering, those who ask my help to fulfill and satisfy mundane desires, to them I once again declare that as I am not a sadhu, a saint, or a mahatma, mahapurush, or yogi, to seek these things through me is but to court utter disappointment, though only apparently. For eventually, this disappointment is itself invariably instrumental in bringing about the complete transformation of mundane wants and desires. The sadhus, saints, yogis, walis, and such others who are on the via media can and do perform miracles and satisfy the transient material needs of individuals who approach them for help and relief. The question therefore arises that if I am not a sadhu, not a saint, not a yogi, not a mahapurush nor a wali, then what am I? The natural assumption would be that I am either just an ordinary human being or I am the highest of the high. But one thing I say definitely, and that is that I can never be included amongst those having the intermediary status of the real sadhus, saints, yogi, and such others. Now, if I am just an ordinary man, my capabilities and powers are limited. I am no better or different from an ordinary human being. If people take me as such, then they should not expect any supernatural help from me in the form of miracles or spiritual guidance. And to approach me to fulfill their desires would also be absolutely futile. On the other hand, if I am beyond the level of an ordinary human being, and much beyond the level of saints and yogis, then I must be the highest of the high. In which case, to judge me with your human intellect and limited mind, and to approach me with mundane desires, would not only be the height of folly, but sheer ignorance as well. Because no amount of intellectual gymnastics could ever understand my ways or judge my infinite state. If I am the highest of the high, my will is law. My wish governs the law, and my love sustains the universe. Whatever your apparent calamities and transient sufferings, they are but the outcome of my love for the ultimate good. Therefore, to approach me for deliverance from your predicaments, to expect me to satisfy your worldly desires, would be asking me to do the impossible, to undo what I have already ordained. If you truly and in all faith accept your Baba as the highest of the high, it behooves you to lay down your life at his feet, rather than to crave the fulfillment of your desires. Not your one life, but your millions of lives would be but a small sacrifice to place at the feet of one such as Baba, who is the highest of the high. For Baba's unbounded love is the only sure and unfailing guide to lead you safely through the innumerable blind alleys of your transient life. They cannot obligate me who, surrendering their all, body, mind, possessions, which perforce they must discard one day, surrender with a motive. Surrender because they understand that to gain the everlasting treasure of bliss, they must relinquish ephemeral possessions. This desire for greater gain is still clinging behind their surrender, and as such, the surrender cannot be complete. Know you all that if I am the highest of the high, my role demands that I strip you of all your possessions and wants, consume all your desires, and make you desire less rather than satisfy your desire. Sadhus, saints, yogis, and walis can give you what you want. But I take away your wants and free you from attachments and liberate you from the bondage of ignorance. I am the one to take, not the one to give, what you want or as you want. Mere intellectuals can never understand me through their intellect. If I am the highest of the high, it becomes impossible for the intellect to gauge me, nor is it possible for my ways to be fathomed by the limited human mind. I am not to be attained by those who, loving me, stand reverentially by in rapt admiration. I am not for those who ridicule me and point at me with contempt. To have a crowd of tens of millions flocking around me is not what I am for. I am for the selected few who, scattered amongst the crowd, silently and unostentatiously surrender their all, body, mind, and possessions to me. I am still more for those who, after surrendering their all, never give another thought to their surrender. They are all mine who are prepared to renounce even the very thought of their renunciation, who, keeping constant vigil in the midst of intense activity, await their turn to lay down their lives for the cause of truth at a glance or sign from me. Those who have indomitable courage to face willingly and cheerfully the worst calamities, who have unshakable faith in me, eager to fulfill my slightest wish at the cost of their happiness and comfort, they indeed truly love me. From my point of view, far more blessed is the atheist who confidently discharges his worldly responsibilities, accepting them as his honorable duty, than the man who presumes he is a devout believer in God, yet shirks the responsibilities apportioned to him through divine law and runs after sadhus, saints, and yogis, seeking relief from the suffering which ultimately would have pronounced his eternal liberation. To have one eye glued on the enchanting pleasures of the flesh and with the other expect to see a spark of eternal bliss is not only impossible, but the height of hypocrisy. I cannot expect you to understand all at once what I want you to know. It is for me to awaken you from time to time throughout the ages, sowing the seed in your limited minds, which must in due course and with proper heed and care on your part germinate, flourish, and bear the fruit of that true knowledge which is inherently yours to gain. If, on the other hand, led by your ignorance, you persist in going your own way, none can stop you in your choice of progress. For that, too, is progress, which, however slow and painful, eventually and after innumerable incarnations, is bound to make you realize that which I want you to know now. To save yourself from further entanglement in the maze of delusion and self-created suffering, which owes its magnitude to the extent of your ignorance of the true goal, awake now. Pay heed and strive for freedom by experiencing ignorance in its true perspective. Be honest with yourself and God. One may fool the world and one's neighbors, but one can never escape from the knowledge of the omniscient. Such is the divine law. I declare to all of you who approach me, and to those of you who desire to approach me, accepting me as the highest of the high, that you must never come with a desire in your heart which craves for wealth and worldly gain, but only with a fervent longing to give your all, body, mind, and possessions, with all their attachments. Seek me not in order to extricate you from your predicaments, but find me in order to surrender yourself wholeheartedly to my will. Cling to me not for worldly happiness and short-lived comforts, but adhere to me through thick and thin, sacrificing your own happiness and comforts at my feet. Let my happiness be your cheer and my comforts your rest. Do not ask me to bless you with a good job, but desire to serve me more diligently and honestly without expectation of reward. Never beg of me to save your life or the lives of your dear ones, but beg of me to accept you and permit you to lay down your lives for me. Never expect me to cure you of your bodily afflictions, but beseech me to cure you of your ignorance. Never stretch out your hands to receive anything from me, but hold them high in praise of me, whom you have approached as the highest of the high. If I am the highest of the high, nothing is then impossible to me. And though I do not perform miracles to satisfy individual needs, the satisfaction of which would result in entangling the individual more and more in the net of ephemeral existence, yet time and again, at certain periods, I manifest the infinite power in the form of miracles, but only for the spiritual upliftment and benefit of humanity and all creatures. However miraculous experiences have often been experienced by individuals who love me and have unswerving faith in me, and these have been attributed to my nazar, or grace on them. But I want all to know that it does not benefit my lovers. But I want all to know that it does not befit my lovers to attribute such individual miraculous experiences to my state of the highest of the high. If I am the highest of the high, I am above these illusory plays of Maya in the course of the divine law. Therefore, whatever miraculous experiences are experienced by my lovers who recognize me as such, or those who love me unknowingly through other channels, they are but the outcome of their own firm faith in me, their unshakable faith often superseding the course of the play of Maya, gives them these experiences, which they call miracles. Such experiences derived through firm faith eventually do good, and do not entangle the individuals who experience them into further and greater illusions, bindings of illusion. If I am the highest of the high, then a wish of my universal will is sufficient to give, in an instant, God realization to one and all, and thus free every creature in creation from the shackles of ignorance. But blessed is knowledge that is gained through the experience of ignorance, in accordance with the divine law. This law is made possible for you to attain in the midst of ignorance by the guidance of perfect masters and surrenderance to the highest of the high.
Several people in Europe have asked if each of our group leaders would say a word. Around
that the sign in India for the highest of the high, in greeting the highest of the high, or the sign of highest respect is this. Or usually they do this.
Dana lifts his hands over his head. His hands are joined, and he raises them over his head.
It would be this, or I suggest this. And this is all I have to say. It's something I desire with all my heart to do myself. I will merely say Avatar Mayor Baba Ki Jai three times, and the rest of us, Baba pointed this out to a group of them who were shouting Avatar Mayor Baba Ki Jai at the top of their lungs in the south was there. He said, I want you to shout that in your hearts. Supposing then I'll be the only one to say it, and the others have this picture yourself in your hearts, standing like this and saying that. Is that all right with you? No objection? I attend the ritual. And Baba has located, he sent me an Indian man over there for 1 month. And some of you met in Los Angeles, and he told me these such, not this, but similar things. Is that all right? No objection? Anybody see that? Right. Picture yourself and shout in your heart, but not out loud. Let me see it, please. Avatar Mer Baba Ki Jai. Avatar Mer Baba Ki Jai. Avatar Mer Baba Ki Jai.
Marguerite, would you say a word in every life? Oh. I don't see I can add very much to what Dana just said. I think I tell us just about what is in most of our hearts, at least I hope so. Never one heart for that matter. We all have our own individual feelings, innermost feelings, that is to say, about the avatar of the age. And we're all going on trying to understand more of what he wishes us to understand up here. Expressing it in our daily lives, no matter how deeply, more or less, we're immersed in the mundane duties of our earthly journeys, probably millions more. And that we could just all try to continue to the best of our ability, sincerely, to do exactly as he wishes us to do. Specifically to loving, to try to love him 100%. I think we've been doing very well indeed. That's about all I wish to say.
How about Jean and Darwin next week?
I would wonder to myself, does Baba know that I'm thinking of him here? Do I really have a contact with him? Or is it just my imagination? Well, in 1952, when Baba came to the center, he took us up to his house, and he pointed out the view, of course, and then he walked up the steps to the veranda. And he turned around, and he just snapped his fingers at me, and he pointed just like that. And he has a way of projecting a whole panorama, you know. And so suddenly, just like that, I said, "Oh, Bobby, you're reminding me of how I used to come here and think of you." And he nodded and turned around and went in. Another incident which I think illustrates Baba's way of talking to many people, you might say all at once. I've noticed that Baba will say things which may seem irrelevant to some people, but they are relevant to others. For example, in India, time and again, when walking with Baba over the hills, through the villages, among the crowds, and when the thousands came to offer themselves at his feet, we were not only touched with the incredible nature of what was happening around us, but we felt, and each day stronger, that we were in the presence of God incarnate. For all the world, it was like reliving some of the scenes from the New Testament. On one occasion, we were walking up the hill to the lounge room in the morning, and I was a few paces to the right of Baba and a little bit in back, and I was thinking about Baba. He had told us a short time before that he would soon drop his body, and that gave me a great deal of distress, of course. And I wondered how we would feel about it. What would our contact with Baba be when he dropped his body? What would happen? And also, among my thoughts, the passage from the New Testament flashed through, Jesus saying to his disciples, "You all say, 'Yes, yes, Lord,' but you do not do the things I tell you." So very shortly, we reached the lounge room and were seated in a big semicircle around Baba, who was seated on the sofa. And after a few very brief introductory comments, without looking at me at all, Baba said, "You all say, 'Yes, yes, but do not do.'" And then, still without looking at me, he said, "When I drop my body, you will love me more than ever. You'll feel closer to me than ever before." And meantime, I'm wondering, I said to myself, this is unfathomable. And as if in answer, Baba said, "Even I myself cannot sometimes fathom myself." I think perhaps those comments will be enough for me. Perhaps someone else will have a few comments.
Anybody else from Schenectady Group want to speak, Jeannie? How about New York? Fred Allen, John?
Well, I do see that those who come from abroad are the patients that have a chance to express themselves this evening. I would rather have heard of here. The export of Baba's teaching, the very greatness of it and all that. I think he could say that very well that Baba's death and so on and so forth. And what I would like to say is that I often find this number of times, and I'll just mention this to Baba recently, that should study Baba's books more thoroughly. I found that many people from various groups have talked about Baba this time and never seem to understand Baba thoroughly. They always seem to say here a sentence and take it there a sentence and somehow to mix it up. And matters of the study of authority. Now, obviously, you want to understand about authority, you need to study the book of authority and establish ourselves in the truth, as it were, and in his teaching, and to be able to teach, or rather, to tell the world more effectively about the truth. That's one point that is so very strongly my first time in conversation from where the group. And this would be a good point. Much closer, and he was much, much more effectively and taken love, which of course is important. We all have love in our hearts, if we have love, then we can teach others to try others too, or tell about that from above. But we have no love, what can we do? Understanding and love are two famous things. That's all I want to say.
About Fred Ella. Do I tell some of your experiences,
Fred? Alice? Well, only experiences have been so few. Ones of the most inner kind. We can't explain them very well, yet they are there. And all I'd like to say a few words on the present situation as Bob has left us. I was thinking about it, and I thought, and now what? What do I take home? What have I gained? And I came to the conclusion that most of the experiences which we lived through here while we were with him are of the deeper kind. We cannot explain them. We put them into stories. We form our own conclusions. Yet they are much deeper. Baba had performed a certain operation on us, on our higher self, and the reaction probably will occur sometime later. The only thing we have to do is be aware of these reactions when they occur and relate them to the Master, as we should all our action. They should be related to our Master. Whether they are good or bad. That's all.
But you long for our food?
Well, I'm no speech maker myself, but there are a couple of points that, well, you might call them experiences, you might not. Since we speaking for ourselves and not the rest of the Florida people, but since we have come in contact with Baba, experiences have piled themselves one on top of the other, so that in the comparatively short time that we have known Baba, I believe we have had more varied experiences, more vital major changes than we would have ordinarily, than we did have in our whole previous lifetime. And I just attribute that to Baba's stepping up our education, so to speak. I don't know what else we'd call it, because it's definitely Baba has been responsible for it. Things that we would not, of our own volition, have even dreamed of attempting, yet they have been done with ease. And we have been put in situations that we would never have been in if it had not been for Baba's influence. I think that's probably all on that point. And there's the other thing I wanted to mention on what John Bass has just said, that we should all read Baba's books. However, I have been quite disturbed. I shouldn't be disturbed at all, I suppose, but I have been. But we all read these things. We all listen to Baba when he says certain things, or when he or when Eric translates certain things. And we all come up with a different interpretation of what has been said. Maybe it's meant to be that way, and maybe it isn't. Maybe the interpretation each person gets is peculiarly for himself on his own level of advancement, if I may call it that, or maybe it's just a misunderstanding. I don't have the answer, But maybe if we read his books over many times and not just once, we might eventually come to be of one mind.
Several times on certain ones. So I took for granted, not only for granted, but I put myself in the position where not to expect anything, not to be disappointed of anything. In that attitude, he seems Baba treated me according to that. So when I'm around, I was in that state of enjoyment, of delight being near Baba, and that was sufficient. But Baba didn't let me be in that state. Every time the role of film is filled and I have to make the changes, I had a feeling not to leave the ground. So the first case, Charmaine was near me. I said, now I've got to change the film so I can take some more pictures. She said, why don't you run up here under the shade in the porch where there isn't much sunlight? I said, I'm afraid he'll call. I have a feeling. And yet, I was no expecting, really, I wasn't. Because I want to leave it according to his statement and let it be in his own will, wishing. So I went up there as I sat and made the changes. A young couple came up. And they said, pardon me, can we sit here for a few minutes? I says, I believe you can, and if anybody tries to chase you out of here, just let me know. So they sat there, and I made the changes, and as I was leaving, talking to them, and I said, pardon me, but I feel I have always that in connection with Baba, or most anybody, but with Baba very strongly, because I know Baba is not far from me, for he is my real self. So I said, I better get down there. I feel it. I didn't go about 50 feet till my name was called. I rushed down there, and when I got in, he motioned to me with a beautiful, his sweet gestures of love. I said, ah, he went this way. And he said, that's all. So, later on, the second day, I believe it was, again, I have to refill the camera. Miss Helen Webb was there. I said, Helen, I've got to get some more film, but I'm afraid to leave the ground. And I told her my experience. She says, I'll stand guard. I said, when he called, if he should call, say, come in and then go after me. So Helen stood there, and I went to get the other film. I got as far as the dining room. My name was called. I rushed back again. I went in, same as usual, beautiful greeting, glove, sit down, and signal, that's all. Out of it. What else would you call it? But being near Baba, what he is doing is for something we don't know. The only interpretation, I said, is discipline that I was satisfied for being in his presence. It does not mean any other, because other things will be words, and it didn't mean it. That's the explanation.
Elizabeth, would you say a word to us? How wonderful
it is. Someone asked me today how the bone got here. That they had all been interested in the bone. And I thought that I could just tell the one incident about the bone, although there's so much about the whole center, how it got here. Of course, the center was an order for Barbara in 1941. Nonina, Machiavelli, and myself were sent to America to look for a place for the center. Barbara gave a description of where, not of where it was, of what it had to be. And one of the things that it had to be was that had to be soil in which there was nothing before. No one had ever lived. It had to be equable climate, so many people from many parts could come here. And those from the north wouldn't be too hot, and those from the south wouldn't be too cold. He said he wanted many people from many lands to be able to come here. It had to have ample water. We don't know why it had ample water, but it had to have ample water. It had to have soil on which many people could be sustained if necessary. And it had to be given from the heart. Now, we looked, not every day, but we listened to where a place might be. Anybody mentioned a place, we were always thinking of the center. But our first thoughts were California. We always thought that California was the ideal place from all those points of view. So the first summer we had off, we went to California. And it was very interesting because that was our first contact with the Sufis there. We took a house. In fact, a friend offered her house. We stayed at San Mateo. And we were there a month. And among the different people that came was Rabia Martin, who had the Sufi group. She said that her group was not as active as it was, but they had a place, and it was an ideal place, and we should go there and look at it. It was neither too hot, and neither too cold, and neither too anything, and it was just right, and it was on the other side of some place that was always good weather, so we went. I think it was July. And as we went in the car, we got cold and colder and colder. By the time we got there, we were completely freezing. And everyone came, and we never had a cold day like this before. Absolutely, cannot understand it, but it's just impossible. And the house wasn't heated, of course, and there was nothing there. And we just, and Rabia froze, and everybody froze, and they could hardly talk. And the only thing we knew was that that was not the place. And we went to Southern California. And they told us of a wonderful place there. There's always the sun is shining and always this, and it was never too hot, never too cold, never too anything. So we went out to a place and it seemed very beautiful. And then we just happened to say, well, what is the water situation? Well, of course, the wells go dry and the rivers go dry. So immediately we knew that that wasn't the place. Always there was something that didn't fit. And after it was as much as 3.5 years, I came down here, and we were still looking, but I didn't come down here to look, because Father had the house at Myrtle Beach, and I always thought of it. It's fairly large land about it, but I knew that several hundred people could never be there. It would never be seclusion with all the people there. So my thoughts were not at all on the center. And after I got down here, thought came to me, years ago I was here. I said, Father, what about those leeks up there? Are they still there? And he said, yes. And years before, we had gone when the time, the only way to get there was no Highway 17. The only way we could go was when the tide was out. Like you saw that wide tide, you could come up in the car, and have, you know, always, of course, a Ford because it was higher above the ground, and rush up. And we never came as far as this lake, you see. We went to what they call the Round Lake, below Chapin Lake. And Narina and I thought it was certainly ideal. This was the early days before we ever thought of the center, you see. And then we had to rush away before this tide came and we got stuck. But that thought had been so far, so latent in our minds, it didn't come until we came down here. So I mentioned to Father that, I said, you know, you love Myrtle Beach and you're always interested in some of your family being interested here. But I said, of course, I couldn't be interested because my interests are in New York, in an active life. But if we could find a center here, then I might become interested. And in any case, we looked. By that time, Highway 17, this trip that I was telling you, Highway 17 was through. And all we had to do is to, we had a car go ahead. And the strange part is that where we went into the center was Long Lake, and we came down exactly where the center is, the circle, where the kitchen is. But we didn't, we landed there. Someone that went ahead and just cut the underbrush, and there we landed, just through the woods. And we said, this was the place. And so we thought, well, it has a lake, it has the ocean, but does it have any drinking water? Does it have any springs? So the first thing we did, we said, well, we'd have to see if there was any water. So the next day or two, they got two burly Negro men, in fact, I think there were three of them, to sink wells down. And they sang the most beautiful spirituals that you could possibly imagine. The first song that was ever, and Baba, who loves, we didn't realize it so much, but as they were putting it on the well, this wonderful spiritual song that was sung. And of course, they found water in 18 feet. So we said, but that's just one. So then they put down one more, and at 21 feet, found water. So then we decided that there's ample water, because we didn't have electricity, that didn't come until much later. And then, of course, the first building to be built was the cabin on the hill. That was Baba's cabin. And everything we did was under handicap. I want everybody to know. Nothing was easy. First place, we were sent in 1941. And then America came into the war, and it became more and more difficult to get any materials. And there was no building allowed. And here, if we found the center, and there was no possibility of building anything. But then, of course, like all Americans, you always told you can't do things until you find out how you can do it. And we found out that, especially women, of course, and they said, well, of course, you can build farm property. And I said, well, what's this? They always begin, if you're going to clear a farm, it has to be in the woods. This is farm. And they said, well, there's no reason why it isn't farm. I mean, and so that you could spend $1,000. That $1,000 went further than any $1,000 ever went, because the builder was very much interested. And he liked the idea. And he built the cabin on the hill, not the bathroom, because there wasn't such a thing. But those two outhouses, let me tell you, we started with the same two outhouses that you see from here, and the cabin on the hill, and a little portion of the kitchen. The front part of it was the porch, and the little back part was the kitchen. And that's what we could get at that time. And it began our, the idea that it was cypress. We wanted it to last. They say cypress is a wood that lasts for 200 years, and it didn't need painting. And that's where we started the cabin on the hill. And then, after that, I'm making this longer, but as long as I'm starting, I might as well say, as Baba was to be in that cabin, we thought, not of all of you or of ourselves, we were thinking of Baba coming from India with his disciples, and that he would want his mandalay with him, you see. And so we had the thinking of the cabin on the hill. We had it like the arm stretched, you see, the cabins that went this way. And they were all supposed to be put in clapping distance of Barbara. Barbara was, you know, would call in those days just by clapping. He probably still does. And we wanted them not too near each other, and yet within sound of Barbara's clap. And anything that was done, you must all know that I did not do it alone. It would not be possible to do it alone. Barbara usually puts together people that are completely different from each other. And the two halves make somewhat a whole, because you approach things from different angles, from different backgrounds, from different temperaments. And I always used to say that whenever Narina and I agreed, it was right. Because we approached it from a different way, but when we finally came to the solution that we both agreed on, there was no question about it. Then, of course, the next part, which I'm getting to about the barn, because Barbara, we thought the war was going to be over soon, and the Barbara was going to come in a very short time, so we were in a great hurry, you see. And incidentally, those buildings that we built, those that we called the caretakers, and the near cabin, and the others, we couldn't build either, but we found another way of doing it, which was that we heard that they were selling hutments. Now, a hutment is where 8 soldiers can live. And so we said, well, we would get a hutment. So we got the hutment, and then later we put the little chimney on. We didn't have any fire, but we had the little chimneys put on. And then we got a Benjamin Franklin stove, with logs, some of which are under there that Sam sleeps with down there. They were taken out later. And they were moved. You could move a house, you see. So they were moved. And later on, of course, they were all nicely sealed in with wood that you see today, nice pine level. But then they were just the outside and no inside to them. So that was all perfectly legal to move a house. So then, knowing that Baba would have many people come, we didn't think stay at the center, but we knew they'd come from all parts. We always had in mind that we had to have a place for at least 150 or 200 people. We didn't think of 230, but Baba always squeezed us in more. And so we thought, well, now with no wood and no possibility, what can you do? And we said, well, if we moved the little houses, maybe we could find a big house. And we looked at all the houses, of course, they didn't seem suitable. And finally the idea came to my mind, or our mind at that time, I guess, that why not a barn? Because a barn was the only thing that was big enough for 150 or 200 people. Well, the minute we got and incidentally, we were living in New York, and all these different things would happen when we'd come down from New York for a while, then we'd go back again. So this trip we went down, went all around the country, saw nothing but barns. And we went up to everybody and asked if they would sell the barn. Of course, we couldn't build another one, and they looked at us and just laughed. I said, well, thank you very much. If there's another time, I might think about it, but we can't do without our barn. Then, one day, we read in the Conway paper, there was a barn for sale. Can you believe it? A barn for sale. And we rushed over. It was a lumber mill that was selling out. They'd all cut down. It was in Conway. They'd cut down in that district all the large trees that they could find, and they were selling out. And among the other things was a barn. And we rushed over, and we saw this barn. Now, this barn was for mules. It had no floor to it. It was on the ground. There were 7 mules here, you see, and one was there. It had a hayloft over there, and those were the doors that you walked out on the ground. Those were the doors. And we were enchanted with it, because we saw this wood, and we said it's going to last for 200 years without painting, and it's, we can't get paint anyway, and it's simply ideal, and we love it. And we asked the man, he said, it's just been sold. Well, we nearly died. You know, you sank. It just didn't find the right thing. So finally, with a bright idea, I said, "Who did you sell it to?" He said, "I have no idea. He lives way off in the country." And I said, "Well, you must have his name written down there if you sold it." Well, he found the name, and we asked several people. I think we went to the police station or something. They said, "Well, if you go down a certain road, there you will find the man." We got to there eagerly to find the man. And the man had just left for Conway, just the road that we'd come down. But his wife was there. And we said, "No, we were very interested to buy the barn. I don't." And she said, "Yes, my husband just came home and told me. And he said that's a wonderful barn. He'd never sell it. In fact, he wouldn't sell it for twice what he paid for it." That immediately gave us a clue. And at that time, you see, it was just an outside structure. And it was, he paid $300 for it. So we said, "But where is your husband?" She said, "Well, he's coming back." We waited and we waited and we waited. And finally, we almost gave up. And I finally said, "Well, now what kind of a car?" Because no one could come down that road from Conway that you wouldn't meet him. "What kind of a car does he have?" Well, she described it. So we went down, and halfway to Conway, we saw this description of this car. And we, like highway women, we stopped the car, you see. We said we wanted to buy the barn. And he said, "But I need that barn. I just bought it." And I said, "Yes, but would you sell it for $600? He said, "Well, I might." You see, it's his wife hadn't told us. So I rushed and got money in cash, and because cash always looks more. Or he could change his mind, or his wife could change his mind. And we got the barn. Well, that was the first cost, of course. Then we had to go back to New York very shortly, and we left it with the same builder that built the others, said, "Now you must bring it over." And it was in a setting of these trees like this, what do you call these trees? We all know. Five oaks. It was in a setting over there, and that's what we loved about it. So then we went to find a place that looked like it. Now, you know where we are, living over there, it's all pines. And there was nothing over here, but we had to go all the way through. We found a grove of live oaks and said, "That's where the wine is being." And I wasn't here when they came over, but they had to take pieces, in sections, you see, and bring it over. And then it was just the shell. There's nothing here, you see, just the shell. And something to hold it up underneath, and it was all the air that blew in and so forth. So later, afterwards, when we could buy the wood, we got this wood, which happens to come from the state of Washington, Ponderosa. And this, the brother, Mr. Truman Moore, carved himself. He said, "Mrs. Patterson, I should love to do something for your mama." And he carved. Later, he's become a very good carver, I understand, as a hobby. But this is the first thing he ever carved himself, and it was from our own trees, the cedar here. And then we came down, and we looked, and we had this forest. See, before, there were stalls, and there was a hayloft. But when we got here, we saw this forest, and Marina and I looked at each other. Too awful, what can we do? I mean, it was nice down here, but up there. And then she got this wonderful idea of just painting the lower part blue. And when you come in, you never notice what holds up the barn. You only see that lovely blue as you come in. And there I'll end, because you could go on and on. But that, there's many a tale in regard to, but that is how the barn got here.
Well, I haven't anything to say. say group-wise. I only want to say, I think behalf of all of us, Mrs. Patterson, this has been one of the loveliest love stories I've ever heard. Because it's the work of love. It had so many elements, if you remember, of the eternal avataric love story. The stable. Just think, all of the elements. Two women, the stable, the manger. Searching, as we all do, looking here and up and down, and trying without being sure whether or when the answer would come, but knowing that it would. I like to think that when we all leave here, that in a sense, if we can, we make our lives sort of a labor of love. Remember the sender, how it had to be, how they went to the West Coast, 3,000 miles away, how many times we've gone more than that away from the place. But it was finally found, work and love, faith. You can all build a Taj Mahal. That's what this is to me, even greater. And it won't fall down and it won't burn down. And you can pass it on to anybody you like. Baba gives you all of the material that you're going to want. You don't have to buy it. You don't have to steal it. You have it. So build whatever you want. So build it for him. And it'll be like this place. And it'll be a thousand centers. And Ms. Patterson, I want to say that as Baba has demonstrated to us, you have also, and we must remember this. He is always a perfect host. And you have been a perfect host. Let us try to keep the same feeling in our homes. Practice what he's taught us and what Ms. Patterson has taught us. All I can say from our group and everyone that take all the love you have here with you. There's plenty of it. You'll never run out. And spread it around and throw it away and just be careless as you can be with it. There's lots more on the way. That's all I have.